and a wonderful, wonderful friend also to KPFK, has donated $5,000 to our transmitter repair fund, which is so amazing. And we love John for that. And he said, let's match this and let's help the station maintain its full power. It is a people-powered station, and you have the power. So please call us right now at 818-985-KPFK. Hit option 2. That's 818-985-5735. Hit option 2, or of course you can go online at any time at kpfk.org. Any additional funds raised for this project will support our daily operations, including resuming regular maintenance at our transmitter site. Thank you so much for participating in our fund drive. We love you and we thank you, and we always invite you to stay aware.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling. You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and on the World Wide Web at kpfk.org.
Lie down, lady bright, in the arms of
is Democracy Now!
Filing a lawsuit against the State Department to force it to finally enforce the Leahy Law and end military aid to abusive units of the Israeli Defense Forces.
Five Palestinian families are suing the U.S. State Department for violating the Leahy Law, which bars the U.S. government from funding foreign military units credibly implicated in gross human rights abuses. We'll speak with one of the plaintiffs and a former State Department official. Then to the sister and husband of Aya Shnur Ezgi Aigi, the American human rights activist who just graduated from University of Washington, killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. They're in Washington, D.C. to demand action.
I have been painfully ripped away from spending time in her memory and forced to sideline my grief in order to scrape and beg daily for the past 3 months to plead with the Biden administration to seek justice for my wife.
And then, as Donald Trump sues the Des Moines Register for publishing a poll before the election that showed him trailing Kamala Harris, we'll look at Trump's renewed war on the press.
I think you have to do it because they're very dishonest, and you need a fair press. And the press says, no, I see others. I have a few others that I'm doing.
As Trump calls the media the enemy of the people, we'll look at his suit against the Des Moines Register and his multi-million dollar settlement with ABC News. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks have killed at least 38 Palestinians and wounded more than 200 over the past 24 hours. Among the latest deaths were 10 Palestinians killed in an Israeli missile attack on the Shati refugee camp and two women killed when Israel shelled a home east of Khan Yunis. In northern Gaza, doctors were forced to close the intensive care unit at the besieged Kamel Adwan Hospital after an Israeli attack triggered a large fire. The UN's humanitarian office warns UN-led missions to supply northern Gaza continue to be overwhelmingly denied, with Israeli forces turning back three humanitarian aid convoys carrying food and water on Tuesday alone. Meanwhile, a senior Palestinian official involved in indirect negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza said talks are in a decisive and final phase. News of a possible truce was welcomed by Gaza residents who've survived more than 15 months of Israel's assault.
Let them stop the war so we can live in peace and they can open the border crossing for us to bring in food and everything we need, flour, diapers, and baby formula. Let them bring in everything for us.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and killed two Palestinians near the town of Sofin on Tuesday. They were identified as 32-year-old Mohammed Ashkar and 31-year-old Dia Salmi. Israeli forces reportedly blocked anyone from approaching the wounded men, leaving them to bleed out before medical help could arrive. Israel's carried out near daily raids across the occupied West Bank, killing at least 800 Palestinians since October 2023 and arresting over 12,000. A United Nations envoy has warned Syria's civil war has not yet ended, despite the removal of President Bashar al-Assad by opposition fighters. On Tuesday, UN Syria envoy Geert Pedersen told the UN Security Council Turkish-backed armed groups are continuing to battle Kurdish groups for control of several areas of northern Syria. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department said it had brokered an extension of a ceasefire deal between Turkey and the U.S.-backed Kurdish-Syrian forces around the northern Syrian city of Manbij. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed that his forces will remain in Syria indefinitely after Israeli troops expanded their occupation beyond the Golan Heights. On Tuesday, Netanyahu and senior Israeli officials toured the peak of Syria's Mount Hermon, which Israeli troops seized after the fall of the Assad regime. The mountain on the border of Lebanon and Syria extends into and even beyond a UN-designated demilitarized buffer zone. This comes amidst growing international condemnation of Israel's plans to build new settlements in the Israeli-occupied parts of Syria, which are illegal under international law. Israeli military bulldozers have begun clearing land for new construction projects in the Golan Heights community of Majd al-Shams, where Druze residents condemn the surge in planned settlements.
Regarding this Israeli occupation, it is not surprising since Israel occupied Palestine and Sinai and occupied the Syrian Golan Heights and Lebanon that it is currently starting a new occupation. Behind us, you can see the digging, which the Israeli army is doing, which is against all international conventions.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have reached a breakthrough in talks that could soon result in an agreement to normalize relations between the two countries. That's according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which reports the deal would see Saudi Crown Prince and de facto leader Mohammed bin Salman agree to a vague commitment to a path towards Palestinian statehood rather than an explicit recognition of a Palestinian state. Meanwhile, human rights groups are blasting the International Soccer Federation, FIFA, for selecting Saudi Arabia to host the 2034 Men's World Cup, citing the exploitation of migrant workers in Saudi Arabia, the jailing of political activists for expressing themselves peacefully, and discrimination against women and LGBTQ plus people. In a joint statement, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others write, quote, "It's evident that without urgent action and comprehensive reforms, the 2034 World Cup will be tarnished by repression, discrimination and exploitation on a massive scale," they wrote. The Biden administration's releasing three more prisoners from the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Pentagon says Mohammed Farik bin Amin and Mohammed Nazir bin Lep will be transferred to their home country of Malaysia to serve an additional 5 years in prison after they pleaded guilty to participating in deadly bombing attacks in Indonesia in the early 2000s. Before they were sent to Guantanamo, both men were held at secret CIA black sites where they were tortured. The U.S. will also release another torture survivor, Mohammed Abdul Malik Bajabu, to Kenya after imprisoning him for 17 years at Guantanamo without trial. In a statement, Amnesty International welcomed the prisoners' release and called for the remaining 27 Guantanamo prisoners to be freed, writing, quote, "President Biden must transfer these men before he leaves office, or he will continue to bear responsibility for the abhorrent practice of indefinite detention without charge or trial by the U.S. government," unquote. President-elect Donald Trump has escalated his attacks on the press. On Tuesday, Trump filed a lawsuit against prominent pollster J.N. Seltzer for her polling firm Seltzer & Company, the Des Moines Register, and the newspaper's parent company, Gannett, alleging violations of the Iowa Consumer Fraud Act. Trump accuses them of, quote, brazen election interference, unquote, over a November 2nd poll that showed former Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris ahead of Trump by 3 points in Iowa. Trump claims news coverage of the poll just days before Election Day was intended to help Harris. Trump ended up winning Iowa with 56% of the vote. This comes after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library to settle a defamation suit filed by the president-elect. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. On Capitol Hill, Democrats have selected Virginia Congressmember Jerry Connolly to serve as the party's ranking member on the House Oversight Committee. He won the role after defeating progressive Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by a vote of 131-84 in a closed-door Democratic caucus meeting. The move rejected mounting calls to select a younger generation of lawmakers to serve in leadership positions following Democrats' disastrous performance in November's election. Connolly will be replacing Congressmember Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who will move on to become the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee when Congress convenes on January 3rd. Authorities in Mayotte are warning of the spread of hunger and disease after Cyclone Chido battered the Indian Ocean archipelago, leaving hundreds, if not thousands, of people dead. Amidst growing anger over France's slow response to the crisis, French President Emmanuel Macron announced he'll visit Mayotte on Thursday. Mayotte is France's poorest overseas territory. Survivors have described apocalyptic scenes in which ramshackle homes were completely blown away by 140-mile-an-hour winds.
It really is a war landscape. Around me, I don't recognize anything anymore. There's not even a tree left. On the hills, there's not even a blade of grass. It's impressive. There were multi-story houses, and everything is gone.
In Mozambique, authorities say at least 34 people were killed after Cyclone Chido made landfall on Sunday. In the South Pacific, at least 14 people were killed and hundreds more injured after a magnitude 7.3 earthquake struck off the island nation of Vanuatu Tuesday. A tsunami warning was called after the quake, but large aftershocks rattled survivors. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office estimates one-third of Vanuatu's population, or more than 100,000 people, have been affected. In media news, CNN is facing widespread backlash after the fact-checking group Verify Psi and CNN's own investigation determined that a person interviewed on a CNN video report claiming to be a Syrian prisoner was actually a former intelligence officer in the Bashar al-Assad regime who once ran a notorious checkpoint in Homs. CNN's report shows journalist Clarissa Ward and her team stumbling upon the person under covers who has now been identified as former Syrian Air Force Lieutenant Salama Mohammed Salam, who claimed to have been held in a windowless cell for 3 months in a Damascus prison. We'll have more on media coverage later in the broadcast. Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York, has been charged with first-degree murder and second-degree murder as an act of terrorism. New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg announced the charges Tuesday, saying Mangione intended, quote, to sow terror. Bragg described the killing as a, quote, frightening, well-planned and targeted murder. 26-year-old Mangione is scheduled for another court hearing in Pennsylvania on Thursday to determine whether he'll be extradited to New York. To see our coverage of the story, go to democracynow.org. And in Greenland, the longtime anti-whaling and environmental activist Paul Watson has been released from a Danish-run jail after authorities rejected a request by Japan to extradite him. Watson was arrested in July as his ship docked in Greenland before setting off to the North Pacific on a mission to intercept a Japanese whaling vessel. Watson co-founded Greenpeace and is the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which takes nonviolent direct action to protect the world's oceans and marine life. Paul Watson spoke to reporters from Greenland's capital Nuuk after his release on Tuesday.
I'm very thankful that the president and the former Prime Minister of France have been extremely helpful. The President of Brazil has been, you know, intervened. Bernie Sanders, my senator, has actually been very helpful. The U.S. Embassy has been very, very helpful also. And but really, the public pressure from all over the world, you know, I've received over 4,000 letters while I've been in prison, has been really overwhelming.
If extradited to Japan, Watson faced a possible sentence of up to 15 years in prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Five Palestinian families have sued the U.S. State Department for violating U.S. federal law by continuing to fund Israeli military units despite their role in gross human rights abuses in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The lawsuit cites the Leahy Law, named after former Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. The lawsuit says, quote, "The State Department's calculated failure to apply the Leahy Law is particularly shocking in the face of the unprecedented escalation since the Gaza war erupted on October 7, 2023, unquote. The lawsuit is supported by Dawn, the D.C.-based nonprofit that campaigns for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. This is a short clip from a video they produced about the lawsuit.
For almost 30 years, the Leahy Law has prohibited the United States from funding foreign security forces that violate human rights. Yet for decades, the United States has consistently ignored persistent and widespread abuses by the security forces of one country, Israel, and refused to block aid to any of its military units. Now Dawn is taking action. We are filing a lawsuit against the State Department to force it to finally enforce the Leahy Law and end military aid to abusive units of the Israeli Defense Forces. This lawsuit isn't just about ending the Israeli exception from enforcing U.S. laws, but preserving the broader principles of accountability, human rights, and the rule of law. We hope our lawsuit will force a long overdue reckoning for Israeli impunity, but also crack down on U.S. foreign policies arming abusive regimes around the globe, in violation of our nation's own laws and principles. This lawsuit also reflects the immense human cost of America's failure to enforce its own laws, continuing to provide Israel with over $20 billion in weapons to terrorize Palestinians in Gaza, where it has killed over 45,000 people, the vast majority women and children.
That video from the D.C.-based nonprofit Dawn that campaigns for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. We're joined now by two guests. Charles Blaha is senior advisor to Dawn. He retired from the State Department last year after over 30 years of service. From 2016 until his retirement, he served as director of the Office of Security and Human Rights, which is responsible for implementing the Leahy Law worldwide. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. And from Philadelphia, we're joined by the Palestinian-American writer Ahmed Moore. Born in Gaza, Moore is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, an advisory board member of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Charles Blaha. You work for the State Department, the agency that you are now suing, for over 30 years. Can you explain more fully the Leahy Law and what you're charging in this lawsuit?
Sure. And thanks for having me. The Leahy Law, as you said, prohibits United States assistance to security force units that have committed gross violations of human rights. It's actually very surgical. And it prohibits U.S. assistance to the specific units that have committed the violations. The State Department has for years in its own human rights reports, including the 2023 reports for Israel and for Gaza and the West Bank, set forth gross violations of human rights by Israeli security forces. Things like torture, extrajudicial killings, like the killing of Aishe Nur Ezgi Egi that you mentioned at the top. Deprived people of their liberty without due process. Rape under color of law. Enforced disappearances. These are allegations and credible reports set forth in the State Department's own human rights reports. And they go back years. Despite all that, the State Department has never once held any Israeli unit ineligible for assistance under the Leahy Law. The lawsuit, which is by the plaintiffs, is designed to try to compel the State Department to obey the law. So in three words, what this lawsuit is about is the State Department must obey the law.
Well, Charles Blaha, what has happened to these reports once the department, once they've been issued to the higher ups in the State Department?
Well, that's a good question, because usually the determinations about whether a unit is eligible or not are not made at the higher levels of the State Department. They're made by experts. They're made by action officers who are versed in the Leahy Law, who know the security forces in question, and who know the facts in question. And these are legal determinations. And one of the problems with the way the Leahy Law is applied, or really not applied to Israel, is that these determinations have been made at the political level. And they have, as I said, resulted in not one single Israeli security force unit ever being found ineligible for assistance.
And how is U.S. military assistance delivered to Israel? In what form and where? And is this a standard practice, the way it's delivered?
Well, Israel is a special case. And we give massive security assistance to Israel. And part of that is a lump sum of over $3 billion annually that goes into an account. And where it goes after that is controlled by Israel. We don't know all the places it goes. We don't know the units it goes to. And that's a problem, because the Leahy Law requires vetting units. In that situation where we can't trace the units to which the assistance is going, the law requires the State Department to give the countries in question, and Israel's one of those, there are a few others, to give the countries in question a list of ineligible units. The State Department has never done that. That has been the law since 2019, and in five years, the State Department has never given Israel a list of ineligible units. It's given lists to the other countries that this law applies to, but not to Israel.
Charles Blaha, you often hear commentators on television, or I should say U.S. government officials, saying, don't be so concerned about this amount of money, $3 billion, because it's really going mainly to U.S. military, you know, to the weapons manufacturers. You hear that not only around Israel, but other countries that get U.S. military aid. Can you explain what actually happens? And is Israel a separate case where you don't know where the money goes, but in other cases, we insist that the money stays with U.S. weapons manufacturers?
Well, part of the money does go to U.S. weapons manufacturers. Part of it actually goes to their competitors in Israel. But the problem from the Leahy Law is, regardless of where that money goes, this is U.S. taxpayer money that's going to weapons that are being used in gross violations of human rights, being used by units that commit gross violations of human rights. That's the problem.
And Blinken's role, your former, well, I don't know if you worked under him, but the Secretary of State. When did you retire exactly?
I retired in August 2023, so before October 7th. And when I retired, I was frustrated at the slowness of that the law of the implementation of the law. It wasn't the reason I retired. I retired because I had been in the State Department for 32 years and it was time to retire. But I was frustrated. But I became more and more frustrated as I saw mounting evidence of gross violations of human rights by Israeli security force units and nothing being done about them.
And did you have conversations with Blinken about it specifically?
No, I was an office director, so I was not what they call up on the seventh floor, up in the highest levels of the State Department. I was an office director, but an office director with really good knowledge of the Leahy Law and how it is applied.
I'd like to bring in to the conversation Ahmed Moore. Is a Palestinian-American writer, advisory board member of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now! Could you talk about your involvement in the lawsuit? You were born in Gaza and still have family there?
Yes, that's right. So I was born in Gaza, moved to the United States as a child, still have most of my extended family in Gaza. And as you can imagine, conditions there have been unlivable for over a year, 14 months now. And so my direct participation in the lawsuit goes to my increasing inability and increasing likelihood, inability to speak with that family members in Gaza, and increasing likelihood that they're going to be subjected to further inhumane conditions and harm. My family's experienced direct loss through the genocide. Most recently, my cousin's 19-year-old son was killed by an Israeli sniper in Rafah. And so the urgency surrounding this lawsuit goes to the fact that the conditions are getting worse. The danger that people are exposed to continues even as we speak.
Ahmed, you wrote a piece recently in The Guardian. The Palestine-Israel nightmare won't end until we accept these basic truths. Lay out your argument.
So, I mean, basically anybody who's been, you don't need to be a sophisticated geopolitical analyst to take a look at a map and realize that there's never going to be a Palestinian state. The pronouncements that emerged in 1993, the White House lawn, the famous handshake between Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister at the time, did generate a lot of hope. You know, I lived as a child in the West Bank, and people were ready, I'd say, to accept a future of two states with everything that entailed, with all of the losses that they'd experienced personally through the Nakba. At that time, Israel was less than 50 years old. People were ready to move on and accommodate themselves to the reality because Israel exists. But over the course of the past 30 years, the acceleration of the settlement project has basically rendered a Palestinian state unrealizable. And you really only need to take a look at how the settlements are arrayed across Jerusalem and the West Bank to realize that there's no contiguous Palestinian state possible in that land. And so people like me accommodated themselves to the idea of one binational state, equal rights for everybody. And it's the framework that we live under here in the United States, and it's workable in lots of different places. And we said, well, why not Palestine, Israel? That no longer seems likely or workable. You speak with people in Palestine, and they're deeply traumatized, and it's unreasonable to ask them to say, well, you know, can you have a shared future in this land with Israelis? So I think that the consensus that's emerging is that we need some kind of separation, even though two states is unworkable. And it's not clear where that goes. In the article, though, I highlight a few conditions that need to be met before we can arrive at a negotiated conclusion or outcome to this horrible nightmare that we've all been living for so long. The first is recognition that Hamas is an ordinary political party, in the sense that it's native to the Palestinian struggle. Hamas was founded long after the establishment of the State of Israel, and it arose in direct opposition to the conditions of the occupation in Gaza. Before Hamas, the chief organization that was described as the terrorists and obstacle peace was the Palestine Liberation Organization. And of course, the PLO accommodated themselves to Israel, and that was the commencement of the Oslo process. So we know that this outright description of people as hardliners or as being fundamentally incompatible with the idea of negotiation and discussion just isn't true. The second element of the argument, so I guess the first one is Hamas is not going away. It's an indigenous party in Palestine. It's employed terrorist tactics, but that doesn't mean that the party itself is going away. or that Palestinian society is going to move away from Hamas just because the United States and Israel demand that it does. The second part of the argument is that that the Palestinians have a right to say that Zionism have the right to say that Zionism is Jewish supremacy in Palestine, and that in order for us to have an equitable conversation about what a future looks like, we need to move past Jewish supremacy in Palestine. We need a basic framework for negotiation and discussion, which moves past the idea that certain people have rights that accrue to them based on an identity, which is immovable, an identity that you're born with. And that's basically the argument. So once we meet these, once we can set a framework, basically, for negotiation and discussion, we can begin to talk about resolving the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. Where we go from there, I'm not sure. I don't think anybody really knows at this stage.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Charles Blaha back into the conversation. Charles, what differentiates this lawsuit from previous ones, against the U.S. government for providing military assistance to Israel, especially in lieu of the fact that Israel, with every war, Israel gobbles up more territory, creates more settlements, and becomes more and more of a rogue state?
Well, what makes this this particular lawsuit by the plaintiffs different are two things. One, it's being brought under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the contention under that act is that the special process that the State Department uses to Leahy vet Israeli units, it's called the Israeli Leahy Vetting Forum, that process is arbitrary and capricious and does not advance the intent of the Leahy Law. In fact, it seems designed to frustrate it. And the second thing about this lawsuit is that given the Supreme Court's recent ruling, overruling the Chevron case, which says that courts have to give deference to agencies' interpretations of laws, that no longer exists. That's been overruled. And as our lawyer laid forth in the complaint, now the courts can look more closely at how an agency or a department implements, or in the case of Israel, fails to implement the law.
We just have 30 seconds, but Ahmed Moore, I wanted to ask why you joined this lawsuit. And given that so many of your family are still in Gaza, those that have survived, their response?
The conditions are dire. I'm writing an essay now about child amputees, and I spoke with a child and her mother, double amputee in Gaza. The conditions of basic life are not being met. Gaza is unlivable. Never mind things like potable water or taking a shower in the morning. Think about defecating in the open, being a woman or a girl who can't, who's menstruating. The basic conditions of life in Gaza aren't being met. And the fact that there aren't being met is a matter of policy that our government is supporting.
Ahmed Moore, Palestinian-American writer, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the State Department, and Charles Blaha, former State Department official, served as director of the office responsible for implementing the Leahy Law. Coming up, we speak with the sister and husband of Ayeshnour Ezgi Aigi, the American human rights activist who just recently graduated from University of Washington in Seattle. She was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. Stay with us.
(818) 985-5735 is the number to call for your support for Democracy Now. 818-985-5735.
They are fighting for survival, fighting for a better life. But war is not the answer, no.
of War by Tony Tuff. The longtime conscious roots reggae singer passed away at the age of 69 in April. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Biden administration is coming under criticism this week for failing to independently investigate the killing of Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, the 26-year-old American activist shot to death by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank in September. The recent University of Washington, UW, graduate was fatally shot in the head after taking part in a weekly protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beitia. Witnesses say she was shot by an Israeli sniper after the demonstration had already dispersed. On Monday, members of her family met with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, but left the meeting saying they had little hope the U.S. will hold Israel accountable. Her family also held a vigil outside the White House on Monday night and a press conference on Tuesday outside the Capitol, where speakers included Democratic Congress member Pramila Jayapal of Washington State.
Outside reporting, including an in-depth investigation by the Washington Post, directly challenges the Israeli government's account of what happened and how Ayşenur was killed. This investigation found that Ayşenur was shot more than 30 minutes after the confrontation that the IDF claimed to be responding to had already ended. And she was killed from more than 200 yards away, horrifically shot in the head. That is not a, quote, mistake, as the IDF has claimed. That is not accidental. I am absolutely appalled with the lack of movement on this case, the lack of attention from the State Department, the U.S. State Department, for the well-being and the safety of our own U.S. citizens. Nothing that I have heard from the State Department gives me any assurance at all that the killing of a United States citizen by the IDF is being treated with the urgency that it deserves. And this is all particularly galling when the U.S. continues to provide unfettered aid to Israel, bullets, bombs, weapons, violating our own domestic Leahy laws and international humanitarian law.
That was Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, represents Seattle, where Ayşenur also grew up and went to college. Pramila Jayapal was speaking Tuesday at a news conference calling for a U.S. probe into Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi's death, shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. We're joined now by Ayşenur's sister, Ozden Bennett, and her husband, Hamid Ali. We thank you so much both for joining us and our deepest condolences on the death of your wife and your sister. Ozden, if you could start off by talking about your meeting with Blinken, if both of you weigh in, why did he agree to meet with you? Your sister is an American citizen, and what he promised.
Mm-hmm. My sister's killing happened over 3 months ago, so we waited a long time to meet with Secretary Blinken. And unfortunately, we didn't get a lot out of that meeting on Monday with him. He stuck to a lot of his talking points, which was that they will review the rules of engagement and conduct within the Israeli military because of their escalations and actions, and essentially kept deferring to the Israeli investigation. Anytime that we countered the comments that he was making, he would just circle back and repeat the same things.
Hamid, let me ask you, has President Biden called you on the death of your wife, or Ozden on the death of your sister?
No. President Biden has not reached out to us directly.
Yeah, I wanted to ask. State Department spokesperson Matt Miller said Monday that Blinken told you that, quote, that Israel has told us in recent days they're finalizing their investigation into the matter. Have you received any communication from the Israeli government at all?
No, we haven't received any communication from the Israeli government. I mean, we've received three pictures with some captions from the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem via from the Israeli government via the embassy in Jerusalem. But that's about it. There's been no other communication.
And when we ask Blinken for what communication or documents or anything they've received from Israel themselves, the answer was nothing at this time.
Hamid, can you tell us about your wife? The university, went to University of Washington, graduated, and then what happened on that fateful day?
Yes, as I understand it, and as I've been told by eyewitnesses, and as I've read in the Washington Post investigation, she attended a weekly demonstration in Beta against an illegal Israeli settlement. She was there as an international observer. She was not part of the protests in the same way that she was not participating necessarily. She was there to document and as a protective presence and to bear witness, really, of their right to protest against that illegal settlement. She was standing under an olive tree. She had just helped an older woman who was also there as an international observer who had just sprained her ankle. And the last conversation that they had was that they felt safe in that position underneath that olive tree. And then that's when she was shot.
And Austin, could you tell us, your sister was drawn to advocating for human rights around the world. Could you talk about her growing up and her decision to get involved in these kinds of activities?
Mm-hmm. Growing up, even from a young age, she was just always very drawn to helping her community, helping people in need, taking mentorship positions, volunteering where she could. And starting in high school, she became really politically engaged in the Seattle community around Trump's election, for example. She was really moved by Bernie Sanders and his messaging. She was really moved against what Trump was messaging at the time and trying to implement. And she really rallied protests at that time in Seattle. And through the years, she's volunteered abroad in Myanmar to help relief efforts there. She related to what's happened in Gaza since October 7th, had raised over $40,000 working with the community at large, putting together a fundraiser, an art fundraiser, to help give aid to children in Gaza. She was a huge part of the student leadership that led the encampment movement on the campus of University of Washington. She was at the negotiations table trying to push the president and the administration on campus to divest from certain companies that were harming Palestinians. And even after all that, she felt like what she had done wasn't enough. And she felt moved to do what she could. And she felt like, in her words, the least she could do was to go there, bear witness as an international observer and document the injustices that she was seeing and hopefully be have the Israeli military think twice before using lethal action, which unfortunately is what killed her that day.
Hamid Ali, you wrote an op-ed in The Hill newspaper in Washington that was headlined, "Why Isn't Israel Being Held Accountable for Killing My Wife and Other Innocents?" If you can answer that question right now, and what exactly Blinken said he is waiting for, if he's talking about an Israeli military investigation, I wanted to go back to what the State Department originally said, Matt Miller saying Israel has told us in recent days they're finalizing their investigation. Your meeting with all sorts of Congress members, right, Jim McGovern, Pramila Jayapal, Senators Jeff Merkley, Chris Van Hollen. Chris Van Hollen, who's called for the release of the investigation of the well-known journalist, also American, the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed, May 11th, 2022, by an Israeli sniper as she was covering the Israeli raids into the Jenin refugee camp. What would it look like if the U.S. held Israel accountable for the death of your wife?
Well, simply to begin, accountability starts with an investigation by the U.S. of the killing of one of its own citizens by an ally. I think that's where it starts. Accountability, I mean, nothing will bring my wife back, but at the very least, we can hold those who were responsible, for example, the soldier who fired that bullet, the unit commander who gave the order, and anyone else responsible for that action being taken, face some sort of punishment. Because I think the answer to the question of why my wife is not getting justice is because Israel enjoys this level of impunity throughout his existence that no other country, no other state in the world enjoys. And it seems to be unconditional at this point. I mean, I don't know what else needs to happen.
Are you calling for something to happen before Trump takes office? Are you concerned about what will happen next?
I think it should happen as soon as possible. We've been saying this since September. I don't think the election has anything to do with it. I don't think Trump coming into office changes anything. I think I hope any administration would take seriously the killing of one of its citizens. So 30 days are left in this administration. That's a long time, I think, for someone to just simply make a statement, namely President Biden or Secretary Blinken, to just say, hey, I think we need an investigation into the killing of Aisha Noor. Because there's still a lot of time, and I don't want to take ownership off of the administration for what's happened here.
And Amita, I wanted to ask you, she was also a dual citizen. She was a citizen of the U.S. and Turkey, and Turkey has opened its own investigation into the killing. Have you heard anything from the Turkish government?
The Turkish investigation is ongoing as far as I know. I don't know as many of the details there, but I think it just speaks to the stark contrast into these two governments of which she was a citizen. My wife was a citizen. One government has taken no pause, no hesitation to begin seeking justice for one of its citizens. And the other government, the U.S., has been dragging its feet, basically not doing anything and letting the military and the government responsible for killing her take the lead and investigate themselves, which we've seen historically has never proven any accountability, has never brought forward any accountability, especially, like you said, in the current administration, even with Shireen Abu Akleh that you mentioned earlier.
Mm. Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. And again, our deepest condolences. Hamad Ali is the husband of Aisha Noor Ezgi Aygi, the 26-year-old American Turkish citizen who was shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank in September. We'll link to your article in The Hill. And we want to thank Asden Bennett, the sister of Aisha Noor Ezgi Aygi. They have both just returned from a meeting with the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken. Coming up, we look at Donald Trump's war on the press as he sues the Des Moines Register and ABC News settles a lawsuit that Donald Trump brought against them for over $15 million. It's not clear why. Stay with us.
Well, you heard it from Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! That Trump has seen the media as the enemy. So, does this mean KPFK? 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK to keep Democracy Now! And KPFK listener-sponsored radio on the airwaves. 818-985-5735. Pledge online at kpfk.org. We'll be speaking with Amy Goodman at the top of the hour. Stay with us for more Democracy Now! Coming up.
The Past, the Present by Kapla. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's renewed war on the press, which he's often called the enemy of the people. And in one recent rally, he talked about how someone could shoot through the press. On Monday, the president-elect sued the Des Moines Register. Parent company is Gannett and the pollster Ann Seltzer for publishing a poll just before the election that showed Trump trailing Harris in Iowa. Iowa. Well, Trump ended up easily winning the state. He's now accusing the paper of committing, quote, brazen election interference, unquote. Trump laid out his plans to target the Des Moines Register and other news outlets during a news conference Monday at Mar-a-Lago.
And I feel I have to do this. I shouldn't really be the one to do it. It should have been the Justice Department or somebody else, but I have to do it. It costs a lot of money to do it, but we have to straighten out the press. Our press is very corrupt, almost as corrupt as our elections.
Trump's lawsuit against the Des Moines Register came just days after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, settled a defamation suit filed by Trump. The network agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library and pay $1 million in legal fees to Trump's lawyer. Trump sued the network after ABC anchor George Stephanopoulos said Trump was found liable for rape in a 2023 civil case in Manhattan brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. ABC has been widely criticized for agreeing to settle instead of going to court to fight what many believed to be a winnable case. The prominent attorney, Mark Elias, responded to the settlement by writing, "Knee bent, ring kissed. Another legacy news outlet chooses obedience," unquote. The New York Times is reporting Trump and his allies are threatening to file more defamation lawsuits and attempt to crack down on unfavorable media coverage. Trump has also picked Kash Patel to head the FBI. Patel has a record of threatening to go after journalists. We're joined now by Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. His latest piece is headlined, "Trump's Attack on the Free Press is Just Getting Started." Chris, start off with the Des Moines Register suit and then move on to ABC. What's happening here?
Well, what's happening is a very clear pattern in Trump's public life. It actually well antedates his rise to political power. He made a practice of frequently going after journalists for defamation. He famously sued one of his biographers who wrote in his this biography that Trump did not qualify as a billionaire. And in his subsequent deposition, Trump basically said he was a billionaire because he felt like a billionaire. This is a longstanding pattern of just intimidation of the press. And Trump was very open as a private business person that that was his aim. He wanted to exert a chilling effect on people doing critical reporting from him. Now, of course, he has the awesome power of the federal government behind him or prospectively behind him. And ABC disgracefully capitulated right away. And the Des Moines Register suit is a clear auger of what's lying ahead. At the Mar-a-Lago conference you mentioned, Trump also threatened to sue Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, the Pulitzer Prize, Pulitzer Peace Prize committee for these, you know, alleged offenses against basically Trump's bottomless vanity. So by capitulating, you know, sort of preemptively the way ABC has, this news organization has set the stage for a torrent of similar suits like this. You know, Trump will end his henchmen like Kash Patel. Also, Pete Hegseth has threatened a defamation suit against the person alleging sexual assault against him. You know, this will be a prime MO of the second Trump administration. And it's very worrisome that even before Trump takes office, ABC is without cause, you know, giving in. It sends a very distressing signal. In point of fact, what George Stephanopoulos said on the air was just a paraphrase of what the judge in Trump's, in the E. Jean Carroll case, said. He said that even though Trump's conduct in the case did not rise to the strict definition of rape under New York law, any common sense understanding of rape suggests that Trump did, in fact, commit that act.
So the judge said that.
The judge in the case. So there is not, this was not George Stephanopoulos just randomly popping off on the air. It was a documented claim.
And Chris, I wanted to ask you, in the Des Moines Register lawsuit, Trump is alleging consumer fraud by the Des Moines Register as a weapon. Could you talk about that particularly, and also the impact on these media companies, of many of which tend to want to settle just to get rid of a lawsuit?
Right, right. The fraud charge is, you know, as far as I know, has no legal basis. You can't, you know, just say because a pollster got something wrong, there is some deliberate intent to mislead. It's a plainly frivolous suit, but that is the point. This is a show of power on the part of an administration that we know from its prior turn in office takes every opportunity to demonize, harass, and intimidate the free press. The Des Moines Register suit is very much like the Trump biography suit I mentioned earlier. It's just his vanity was affronted by poll findings that, you know, turned out to be wrong. You know, I don't know what he can assert the damage has been if he won Iowa by 15 points after this poll was released. It is just a plain effort to harass and intimidate. To its credit, the Register's parent company, unlike Disney, which owns ABC, indicates it will be putting up a robust defense and you know, in a sane court system, they will prevail. But, you know, all of this takes resources and money. And as you mentioned, Juan, you know, big companies don't want to be bothered with the hassle of, you know, going to court, even though, you know, these companies also have libel insurance precisely for cases like this. And they don't actually, you know, tend to suffer in terms of the bottom line.
I mean, this is extremely serious. When you look at the amount that ABC settled for, they were just about to go to depositions, right, of George Stephanopoulos and Trump, to discovery. So ABC called that off. $15 million plus another million for lawyers' fees. Any smaller news organization couldn't possibly deal with something like this. Then you have these news divisions that are not, profitable. They only profit Democracy, but so-called, you know, financially profitable from these multinational or these very large corporations that own lots of other things like Bezos with the Washington Post. Right. And they care more about that other stuff. They don't want to be seen unfavorably by Trump. So they settle on the news issue. This is so extremely disturbing.
Yeah, and this is what happens when you have large corporations who are not, they don't have journalistic values, they don't have journalistic priorities. As you said, the news operations are lost leaders for these figures. And Jeff Bezos has billions of dollars in government contracts. A publisher of the LA Times, it's the same story. He has extensive pharmaceutical holdings that come under federal regulation. So he, too, is preemptively knuckling under to the Trump administration. He's killed editorials critical of Trump. He's installed this absurd new feature for readers of the paper to track bias, and he's insisted that anything critical of Trump run alongside in the op-ed section something that's the opposite point of view. This is more than just callow both sidesism. This is just craven corporate misconduct.
Very good. That's Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you. Yes. This is what happens.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the potential, what Trump could do with the FCC, especially in terms of broadcasters. Are there any concerns in that area?
Oh, absolutely. Cameron Barr, his nominee to head the FCC, is a very vocal critic of, you know, what in MAGA land is considered, you know, mainstream media censorship. He has gone on and on about how big tech in particular is, you know, during COVID and at other times have allegedly suppressed pet MAGA causes and talking points. So, there's a very real and immediate danger of, you know, the call will be coming from inside the White House soon when, Trump's FCC starts implementing policy. And it is all of a piece. It's really important to underline that, you know, what we're going to see, I think, is what happened in Hungary under Orbán's rise to power. Trump and J.D. Vance are both ardent admirers of Viktor Orbán, and Orbán basically used his version of Elon Musk to buy out the national press and turn it into a party propaganda arm. And, you know, that is a very real and present danger with Trump coming back into power and feeling this kind of impunity and this drive to avenge the people he sees as his enemies.
You're listening to Chris Layman, is a D.C. editor of The Nation magazine, talking about the media today, the $15 million settlement that ABC made with Trump.